Welcome to Shield of the Republic, a podcast sponsored by the Bulwark and the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia and dedicated to the proposition articulated by Walter Lippmann that a strong and firm foreign policy and balanced foreign policy is the shield of our democratic republic. I'm Eric Edelman. I'm a counselor at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. I'm also a non-resident fellow at the Miller Center and a Bulwark contributor. And I'm joined this week by friend of Shield of the Republic and now in pole position as the guest who's had the most appearances, which has, I think, something to do with how prolific he is as a historian, Hal Brands. Hal, welcome to Shield. Welcome back to Shield of the Republic.
Thank you, Eric. It's a great pleasure to be here. And it's my status as most frequent guest is all the sweeter because it comes at the expense of my good friend Peter Fever, who I understand is in second place. So I'm extra delighted to be here today.
Yeah. So you've inched past got your nose past Peter at the tape here, but well, I'm sure we're going to have Peter back at some point soon. But Hal, a lot of things to talk to you about, but in addition to your weekly Bloomberg column and frequent appearances in foreign affairs, and I want to come back to your most recent foreign affairs article, you also are the editor of a new volume that's just appeared, War in Ukraine, Conflict Strategy and the Return of a Fractured World, published by Johns Hopkins University Press. I want to let our listeners and viewers know that you can actually access electronic version, a PDF version of the book by going to press.jhu.edu. You'll be able to find the book there. And you can also order a hard copy if you like from Amazon. But Hal, explain to our audience a little bit of how this book came to be.
Sure. And I should say at the outset, this is the best kind of book because it's free. And so you can buy a copy if you like, but you can also, as Eric mentioned, just go and download it. It's available open access, so anybody can get access to any part of it that they want. The idea was to get together a group of really excellent world-class commentators to take stock of the war basically 2 years in and to think about how it had started, how it had unfolded since February 2022, and then what its global implications have been and will be in the future. And anytime you're trying to do something like this, you're shooting at a moving target, but we were aided in the fact that this is a little bit of an Insta-book. So I invited people to a conference that was held in February, and then the book came out 6 weeks later. And so, you know, hopefully these essays have not yet reached their sell-by date and will not for some time. It's a great group of contributors that I had the privilege of sort of pulling together. And it, you know, people like Steve Kotkin, Ann Applebaum, Michael McFaul, Frank Gavin, a variety, Lori Friedman, Mike Kaufman, you know, a lot of people who have been sort of most visible in terms of talking about the Ukraine war and its impacts on the international system. And so I think there are about 17 essays in the volume, and they give you a really interesting picture of the war and all of its origins, dimensions, and implications.
Yeah, I don't want to make any invidious comparisons or you know, injure anybody's vanity by leaving them out. But, you know, a couple of the essays really jumped out at me. I mean, Lori Friedman's essay about Putin as a strategic fanatic, for instance, Frank's essay on the nuclear aspects of this, Mike McFaul and Rob Person's essay on how the war came to be. There are a lot of really great, and you know, my colleague Tom Mankin's essay on doctrine, a military doctrine, and what that tells us about the war. Really a lot of great work here. And again, I don't mean to slight anybody who I didn't mention. You mentioned some as well. I want to say that having worked with you on a previous book and having blurbed this one, I take my hat off to you, particularly in terms of herding all these cats in a very short period of time to actually get them to pony up their contributions. And it's, you know, the quality in a lot of instant books, as you said, is, you know, sometimes, you know, a little bit spotty. This is really, I think, very high quality volume. So I really take my hat off to you for doing that. You also provided an introduction, Hal, that kind of outlined six themes that kind of came through all of these essays collectively. Could you run through the six themes a little bit? Because I think they're worth, you know, sort of taking some time with.
Sure. So I'll do the Reader's Digest version of it here, and then we can dig deeper into whichever ones may be of interest. You know, one of the neat things about doing a volume like this is you get to try to take it all in and then figure out what it all means. And so in my introduction, I wrote a little bit about some themes that I had written about in other places, but also stuff that emerged from the work that the contributors who really did, you know, most of the heavy labor in this endeavor had put together. And the six themes that sort of stuck out were, first, this war, it's worth remembering, did not begin in February 2022, even if that's when the most intense and catastrophic phase began. It obviously dates back to February 2014 and Putin's taking of Crimea and subsequent intervention, first covert and then overt in eastern Ukraine. But Putin's project to sort of control Ukraine in one way or another dates back at least a decade before that to his efforts to intervene in the 2004-2005 presidential elections there, the failed effort to do so, which touched off the Orange Revolution in the first place. And then the Ukraine war has contexts that go much, much deeper than that. And so you can think of this as one of many wars of the Soviet succession, basically the violent conflicts that played out in the post-Soviet space as part of the long collapse and then attempted resurrection of that empire. You can think about it in the longer run of Russia-Ukraine relations, as Vladimir Putin clearly does. Or you can think about it in a way that I talk about in a forthcoming book, in the sense that Ukraine has actually been at the center of all of the great power clashes of the past 100 years, because it really sits at the hinge of Europe and Asia. And so if you're a Eurasian power expanding into Europe, you basically got to go through Ukraine. If you're a European power expanding to Eurasia, you basically got to go through Ukraine. And so in World War One, World War Two, and the Cold War, it played an important role. So that was theme one. Theme two was that this particular phase of the conflict emerged from a double failure. It was a failure on the part of the West to deter the Russian assault in February 2022, but also a Russian failure to achieve political control of Ukraine through any means short of all-out war. And so to pick up on the second part of that first, you know, Putin had been after this for two decades, and he had started with poisoning and political meddling. He had moved on to sort of limited land grabs and covert interventions, then kind of the frozen conflict approach. And the problem was that Ukraine was not reacting as Putin hoped Ukraine was reacting. And so every time he intervened in Ukraine or he nibbled off a piece of it, what remained of Ukraine became more pro-Western, more likely to align with the United States, the transatlantic community, and the European Union. And so Putin found himself in a situation in early February 2022 where he was pushing Ukraine farther and farther away from Russia, and I think was genuinely concerned about where that was going, even though he had gotten himself into that pickle. And so for a variety of reasons, chooses February 2022 to escalate in a big way. But of course, the West, unfortunately, had really not done much to convince him prior to February 24th that this would be a disaster for Russia. That's true of the Western reaction to the February 2014 taking of Crimea, which I think we would all agree now was pretty tepid and lacking. And it was true in the run-up to the February 24th invasion as well, when, you know, even as the Biden administration, I think, was genuinely trying to make Putin fear the costs of invasion, it was having a hard time getting the European allies on the same page. It was having a hard time coordinating a sanctions package. And, you know, rightly or wrongly, had decided that any effort to sort of deter militarily was more or less off the table. So that was theme two. Theme three was that the war has played out in ways that were both immensely contingent and fairly predictable. Immensely contingent in the sense that the war did not have to go this well for Ukraine. Everybody thought, almost everybody thought, back on February 23rd, 2022, that Ukraine was just going to get steamrolled in this conflict, that it was going to be over in days or weeks, and you'd have the Russians and sitting in Kyiv and installing a puppet government and probably annexing Ukraine or some large part of it to the Russian Federation. It didn't go that way, but it could have. Had a few battles gone differently in the early going, you know, the Russian attempt to take Hostomel Airport and create the air bridge coming into Kyiv, a few engagements where understrength Ukrainian units, sometimes supplemented by basically civilians or, you know, territorial defense forces, stopped Russian attacks, occasionally at extremely high cost. You could actually have had a scenario where the government collapsed, Zelensky chose to flee, as many people were urging him to, and the Russians do achieve at least some of their objectives, although they probably would have faced an insurgency after that. So that was the contingent part. The predictable part, though, is that since then, the war has played out in ways that I think, you know, students of modern warfare might have expected, right? And so when sort of the coup de main approach fails, you end up with a long, protracted war of attrition. The war reminds us how difficult it is to bust through well-prepared defenses. That's what we saw during the Ukrainian counteroffensive in 2023. It reminds us of, you know, how tough Russia can be even after it gets punched in the face a bunch of times. And, you know, we've really seen a dismaying, but in some ways impressive amount of Russian military adaptation and resilience over the past 18 months in particular, given that it looked like the Russian forces were on the verge of collapse in late 2022. You know, we've been reminded, I suppose, how hard it is for even pretty harsh sanctions packages to inflict real damage on a country, an economy the size of Russia's, and so on and so forth. And so there are patterns of this war, I think, that would have been familiar to people who had paid much attention to 20th century history, even as parts of it were very contingent. Fourth, this war has hastened the division of the international system. Even before this, you had a process where the world was becoming increasingly divided, not quite at Cold War levels, but something like that, between kind of advanced democracies on the one hand and Eurasian autocracies on the other. This war has put that into overdrive, basically, because it has convinced the advanced democracies they need to band together more closely to either counter this aggression or prevent something like it from happening in East Asia. And the Eurasian autocracies have gotten together more closely because Russia has become deeply, deeply dependent on their support and has been willing to cut better deals from the perspective of Iran or North Korea or China than it had been before. There's obviously the third piece of this, which is that it has also accentuated the desire of a number of countries to sort of stay out of this, right, to maintain a degree of flexibility. That's true of everybody from, you know, Saudi Arabia to India to Indonesia. But nonetheless, we've seen sort of the hastening of the return of a divided world, a fractured world, as we call it in the book, as a result of this. Fifth, this war marks the return of great power nuclear crises. We really hadn't seen a great power nuclear crisis in several decades, you know, maybe going back to Abel Archer in 83 or the Yom Kippur War in 73. Before that, there have been pronounced nuclear dynamics from this crisis from the beginning. We've seen the threats that Putin has made somewhat obliquely and that a lot of his subordinates have made much more explicitly, that Russia might use nuclear weapons if the West were to interfere in a more direct way in the conflict. We've seen moments at which U.S. officials appeared to fear that Russia might actually use some sort of battlefield nuclear weapon, particularly in late 22, when the Russian position on the battlefield did not look great. And so we're in for more of this, most likely, because you're going to be coming into an era where great power crises are going to become more common, and we're moving into a more nuclearized world, because it's not just that Russia has modernized its nuclear forces over the past couple decades. China's obviously in the midst of a similar modernization and expansion right now. And then the final one is just that the outcome of the war and the war's effects for international order are yet to be written. And so, you know, as we sit here in early April 2024, things don't look great from Ukraine's perspective, but there's still actually, you know, some variation that's possible in the outcomes of the war. You can imagine one scenario where the U.S. continues to fall on its face in terms of providing more military assistance, and the Ukrainians lose the war in some significant way, probably not ending up with the country conquered by Russia or anything, but forced to make a very disadvantageous peace that turns the country into something like a Russian client state. You can imagine scenarios where Ukraine gets more foreign support, where it develops the ability to defend effectively during this year, maybe go back on the offensive next year and get to a more durable, advantageous peace that perhaps sees it more integrated into Western institutions as well. And so there's a lot of contingency there. And how the war ends will have a big effect on the international system. It'll have a big effect on how people perceive the balance of strength and advantage between the Western democracies and the Eurasian autocracies. It'll have a big effect on the balance of power in Eastern Europe and throughout the former Soviet space and in a variety of other ways as well. And so there's a huge amount that is still at stake in this conflict 2 years in.
Well, that's great. That's a great summary, not only of the, you know, of your introduction, but the themes that, you know, kind of course through the essays and through the conference on which on which all of this was based. And I should, you know, in full disclosure, I should admit to having been a participant in the conference, although not an author of one of the papers. Hal, I want to go back to kind of the second theme. You know, you talked a lot about Russian failures in Ukraine in your comments here, Putin's inability to essentially execute his strategy. I mean, you know, at one level, you could actually say he, you know, he's the author of all his own misfortunes in the sense that, you know, the Orange Revolution, which kicked off a series really of, it wasn't the first, I guess Georgia was technically the first, but it's part of this sort of series of so-called color revolutions that clearly spook Putin and have animated his approach to the West, I would argue, ever since. But a lot of it really is his own doing, his own misjudgments about Ukraine and about you know, Western responses, et cetera. You didn't talk so much about the West's failures. You mentioned a little bit about the Biden administration. I mean, I have a sense that folks in the Biden administration did understand and accept that there had been, as you put it, maybe a little lacking in the response to the 2014 seizure of Crimea. Now, what's interesting about that is President Obama told people at the time that he, A, didn't want to have a nuclear war over Ukraine, and B, that Putin was always going to care more about Ukraine than we did. And therefore, he refused to provide Ukraine with lethal assistance because he believed Russia would always have escalation dominance in this theater. The Biden administration, it seems to me, kind of it buys some of that, but not all of that. And it has tried to be more forward-leaning in aid to Ukraine. I mean, President, then Vice President Biden actually supported lethal assistance to Ukraine in 2014 and 15. He was overruled by President Obama. So he has provided lethal assistance. So there's been a view that's somewhat different from what obtained in the Obama administration. But there has also been this acute concern about the, you know, something else you referred to, which is the danger of nuclear escalation. And I would say almost, you know, religious devotion to the notion that Washington can somehow manage escalation here, that it can control, even while providing a lot of military assistance to Ukraine, the level of violence from, you know, with a 5,000 mile screwdriver, you know, from far away. Do you think that's a fair assessment that they have, on the one hand, you know, gone beyond where Obama was, but on the other hand, they're concerned with some of the same things, which has limited, you know, what they're willing to do?
Yeah. So just to put a fine point on it, I mean, the Biden administration has been willing to help Ukraine kill over 100,000 Russian personnel, right? And that is something the Obama administration never would have done. You know, the Obama administration, the president in particular, thought that it was unacceptably escalatory to provide the Ukrainians with even the most modest amount of defensive weaponry when their territory was under assault. The counter argument at the time, by the way, was that even if you can't kick the Russians out of Ukraine, if you don't show them that they're going to pay a serious cost for this, they're going to do it again somewhere else. And of course they did, right? And so one of the reasons why I think Putin gambled incorrectly that he could get away with this in February 2022 is that he just hadn't paid a huge price for invading Ukraine twice before. So I think we should give credit to the Biden administration for being much more risk acceptant than that. And by being willing to do, you know, some pretty edgy things, if you just read the public press reporting about ways in which U.S. information has reportedly helped Ukrainians carry out some pretty daring and effective operations. I do think I was listening, you know, I'm a longtime listener of your show, to your show, as you know, and you were talking about sort of this Weberian ethic of responsibility. And I think the Biden administration also feels that, you know, whether the risk of nuclear escalation in Ukraine, you know, we may not be able to say whether it's 1% or 17% or somewhere in between, but if it's more than 0%, you can't take that lightly and you can't simply wave it away. And remember that early in the conflict in particular, we hadn't had this sort of 2+ years of interaction with Putin to sort of understand exactly where the red lines might be. It was more we were learning in real time. And so I have a certain sympathy for the approach that the Biden, or at least empathy for the approach that the Biden administration took in 2022, which was to introduce new, more sophisticated capabilities gradually, to see what the Russian response was and then figure out, you know, how you could go further. I think you can maybe make the critique that this pattern has become a little bit of a self-parody at a certain point where, you know, it's Ukrainians ask for something. It's, you know, no, they don't need it. No, we don't have it. No, it would be a bad idea to give it to them. Okay, yes, right? And by the time we get to yes, it's been 8 months from the time the discussion started, by which point, you know, you've lost 8 months by the time the thing appears on the battlefield. And that's one of the reasons that, you know, we sometimes find ourselves in a little bit of a difficult spot now. But, you know, I'm not sure, and this is maybe where I depart a little bit from the critiques that some of the more hawkish observers have issued. I'm actually not sure that if the U.S. had been willing to provide a TACMS in 2022, that we would be in a fundamentally different place than we are today. I think it's possible, you know, I think more sooner would have been better. But if you think about, you know, the challenges that the Ukrainians have had in scaling offensive operations, if you think about how worn out Ukrainian forces were at the end of 2022, when I think they really didn't have much choice but to pause after Kharkiv and Kherson, I'm not sure that they sort of would have won the war by now had the U.S., you know, provided F-16s or Abrams or ATACMs, even though the synergistic effect of those capabilities would have been positive.
Yeah, I also think more would have been, more sooner would have been better. I do think there's an argument that longer range strike capability earlier might have made it more difficult for the Russians to dig in the, you know, winter of 22 and into the spring of 23. That might have changed the battlefield dynamic a bit. But again, you know, that's speculative. You don't know. And the other thing, of course, is, and this is really coming home to roost for the Ukrainians now, the Ukrainians just are not generating enough manpower. And that's in part self-imposed because of their reluctance to move the age of conscription down from 27. I mean, you know, this is something I think we've mentioned before on the show, which is you talk to folks who've been involved in the training of Ukrainian forces in Europe at UCOM, and they're all astonished at how old these guys are, you know, because they're not, you know, they're used to our system where we're basically intaking 18 and 19 year olds. As opposed to people in their 30s or 40s. And obviously there's an economic side to this. You know, the most productive parts of Ukraine's economy are kind of manned by younger folks, and you know, you want you don't want to disrupt that or disturb that. There's also just the, you know, it's not politically popular to, you know, to have a you know, kind of universal draft or conscription at you know, younger ages in Ukraine. So I mean, that's going to be, I think, a pretty serious problem going forward. As a historian, we had Jim Sciutto on a couple of weeks ago, and we were talking about the late 22 period, when, you know, Jim has reported, David Sanger has reported on the concerns the administration had about possible nuclear use. And I think both Elliot and I are somewhat skeptical about that. I mentioned, I think, on Jim's show that a very senior former official who was involved said to me that he thought part of the problem here was a lot of the, with the exception of the president, who's a different category, but a lot of the other people who were involved in senior decision-making had never really thought very hard about the question of nuclear escalation, because it was just outside their, you know, professional and historical frame of reference. I mean, as a historian, how do you see that? Do you see some, virtue in that argument?
Yeah, I mean, I think the last time anybody in the U.S. government had to think about issues of nuclear escalation in a great power crisis was basically 40 years ago at the most generous interpretation. And so it's not surprising that as a nation, we are a little bit rusty in having to deal with this stuff. Now, I think the good news is that during the Cold War, we accumulated a sufficient amount of interaction with the Soviets, now Russians, that we still think, probably accurately, that we and the Russians at least speak some of the same language when it comes to nuclear signaling, right? And so we sort of know what we would look for if we thought the Russians were very serious about using nuclear weapons. You would presumably see them move certain forces around, right? Even if they were using tactical nukes that you can't track that easily. Like, I can't imagine that Putin would use nuclear weapons without putting his strategic forces on higher alert first, you know, because he knows what may come after that. And so, you know, in the way that we talk about these things and the way that we read the signals, I think there's some degree of confidence built up over the course of the Cold War and sort of inherited from that generation that, you know, we're not speaking totally different languages. But nonetheless, I think your basic point remains. I'll just, you know, let me add kind of one other thing about the nuclear dimension of this. I think the fascinating thing about nukes in Ukraine is that nuclear coercion is actually working both ways right now. And so the Russians have effectively coerced the United States and the West in the sense that nobody outside of Emmanuel Macron is, you know, talking about insertion of Western forces into the conflict for a variety of reasons. But one of the big ones is the one that Biden said early on, which is that, you know, that could lead to World War III, and that ain't going to happen over Ukraine. And it has also been successful in coercing us in limiting the willingness of the Biden administration to provide certain types of military assistance, you know, with sort of the 300-kilometer ATACMS being the best, most prominent example on that. And so, you know, Putin hasn't won the war through nuclear coercion, but it's helped him avoid losing the war. The counterpoint to this is that in a quieter way, because we don't talk about it, the U.S. is using its nuclear arsenal to coerce Russia. And so the way I like to illustrate this is, think of the counterfactual where you didn't have a NATO that was backed by the U.S. nuclear deterrent. I think the Russians would be far more active in trying to coerce, perhaps violently, the countries that are supporting Ukraine, you know, especially Poland, right, which is basically the logistical hub for this entire operation. And they can't do that because, you know, of Article 5, which is ultimately underwritten by the U.S. strategic nuclear deterrent. And so we talk about nukes a lot less. We don't advertise it in the same way. But our arsenal, nonetheless, is doing that coercive work for us. It's allowing us to wage you know, what some have called a proxy war in which Russia is paying a terrible price.
Yeah, I mean, I could spend the entire time with you talking about the nuclear issues. I do want to make one observation before I move you to some other issues that I think flow not just from the book, but from your recent foreign affairs article, but which is that it seems to me also there's a very consistent pattern with what we saw observed in the Cold War with Soviet nuclear behavior and Russian behavior in this crisis, which is to say there was a very distinct pattern in many Cold War crises of the most lurid and frightening Russian threats to use nuclear weapons coming at a point in time where the crisis was already en route to resolution. And therefore the nuclear bluff, you know, they knew or had pretty good reason to believe the nuclear bluff was, you know, never going to be called. I mean, it's something that we saw in Suez in 1956, in Berlin, and in the 1958-61 period, and in the 1973 Yom Kippur War. So it's very, very consistent pattern. First noticed, by the way, I would point out, by Francis Fukuyama back when he was, you know, doing, a work on, you know, what we then called Sovietology. And I think you see something similar here, which is, you know, there's, if you look at Putin in particular, his threats, which are very vague and general, I mean, including, you know, comments to the effect of if the West interferes, they're going to see, you know, a response the likes of which they haven't seen or nobody's seen since 1945. Or, you know, there's sort of a lot of allusions to potential nuclear use. But on multiple occasions, including recently in St. Petersburg, when he was put the question directly, are you planning, you know, to use nuclear weapons in Ukraine? And he basically says, there's no use case. There's no way I can use nuclear weapons in Ukraine. I mean, that frees up, of course, Medvedev and others to and the propagandists on TV to, you know, spin these, you know, really, you know, very, you know, scary, you know, nuclear scenarios. But, you know, you just have the sense that this is a kind of learned reflex from the Cold War, how they're doing it.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, the reality is that I worry a lot less about Russian nuclear use now than I did 18 months ago, because the Russians don't need to escalate at this point. I mean, frankly, I think Putin believes with some justification that he's winning the war using conventional weapons at this point. And so the, you know, when we talked about use cases for Russian nuclear escalation, I think the most common scenario was Russian forces have totally lost cohesion, right? And so it's a rout. Putin's going to lose everything in Ukraine, maybe including Crimea, which, apart from being strategically and militarily significant, is significant because it's central to his narrative of how he has resurrected Russian power and prestige on the international stage. So Putin fears military defeat that's going to lead to political collapse at home, and thus uses some limited number of battlefield nuclear weapons as much for the shock value they create as for the battlefield effects that they create. And we are, unfortunately, you know, a long way from a scenario where Russian forces are in headlong retreat right now.
You know, one of the themes of the book is, you know, the impact, as you say, on the resurrection of a kind of fractured world in which you have sort of a breakdown of into kind of two camps, democracy and autocracy, and then a what we might have called in the Cold War era, you know, the Third World, and now we tend to call the Global South. But basically those countries, as you said, who would like to kind of stay out of the line of fire if they can, take advantage if they can of knockdown prices on Russian oil or whatever, and, you know, trade with all sides and then play both sides, you know, to maximum benefit for their own, you know, national interest. But you've written recently about another sort of phenomenon, which is the emergence of tighter collaboration, cooperation among these authoritarian regimes, notably including the PRC, the DPRK, North Korea, and Iran, all working at various levels with Russia, whether it's supplying Russia with, you know, artillery shells, as North Korea has millions of artillery shells by train, whether it's, you know, buying Russian products at you know, very attractive prices in the case of China, but also providing Russia with financing to, you know, work around some of the Western sanctions, but also providing Russia with a lot of dual use technologies, or whether it's Iran providing, you know, Shahed drones that Russia has used to augment its artillery. All of this is kind of a different constellation than we saw before the war, and it seems to be tightening. I mean, I characterize this in a conversation with Bill Kristol as what we've got here is a you know, a global conflict with regional characteristics. You've made the very interesting point that you think Americans may be somewhat blinded to the impact of these quasi-alliances that are emerging, in part because they don't really look like, you know, our alliances and our alliance system. Could you talk a little bit about that? But first, about the uniqueness of our alliances, and then why maybe because of that, we don't really see how disruptive these other arrangements could be?
Yeah, so all alliances are a product of their origins, of their circumstances. And U.S. alliances were created for a specific purpose in a specific context. The context was the early Cold War. And the purpose was to deter aggression by a conventionally superior opponent that was located right next to our allies while we were located a long way away. And all and the U.S. and basically all of its allies, not quite all, but most of its allies were democracies, right? And so as a result of that, U.S. alliances look a particular way. They feature written, formalized security commitments. They are, you know, feature these ritualized public affirmations of commitment. Sometime during their first year in office, every U.S. president, well, almost every U.S. president goes to Brussels or wherever the first NATO heads of state meeting is and reiterates, you know, the Article 5 commitment. They
a rite feature, of passage for all presidents.
That's right, right. You know, they feature extended nuclear deterrence as a central component of the alliance and so on and so forth. And so that's the prism through which Americans think about alliances. And so when somebody says, you know, do country X and country Y have an alliance? We mentally run down the checklist. Well, does it look like the alliances that we have? And if the answer is no, we say, okay, well, that's not an alliance. But what we forget is that our alliances are actually historically quite exceptional. Alliances have taken many forms over the years. And if you asked, you know, Bismarck, does the Russia-China relationship count as an alliance? He'd say, absolutely, it counts as an alliance. Because the question isn't sort of like, what is the form that the relationship takes? It's what geopolitical functions does it serve and what effects does it create? And so when you look at relationships between the and among the Eurasian autocracies, Russia, China, Iran, North Korea, with the exception of China, North Korea, none of them have sort of like a formal mutual defense commitment in the way that we do with our closest allies. But these relationships create these tremendously destabilizing effects. And so if you think about, you know, the Russia, Iran, and Russia, North Korea relationships, well, Iran and North Korea have helped Russia hang in there in Ukraine longer than it would have been able to do otherwise by providing it with drones and missiles and artillery shells and other capabilities, while Russia is accelerating their military technological development through some of the advanced capabilities and know-how and tech that it is providing in return. If you think about the Russia-China alliance, you get huge geopolitical effects out of the fact that this is basically a de facto non-aggression pact. And so Putin can hurl literally his entire army at Ukraine. You know, there's some statistics that indicate 90% of the Russian army is in Ukraine at this point because he has no fear whatsoever of aggression from China on their long land border. And you can go on and on down the list, but when you start cataloging the actual effects that these things create, you see that they have the effect of augmenting both individually and collectively the challenges that these various autocratic states pose to the international system. And by the way, they could do a lot more to destabilize the international system without ever getting close to what we would consider to be an alliance. And so from my perspective, one of the most disturbing aspects of the Ukraine crisis has been the way that it has increasingly convinced the Russians to part with some of their crown technological jewels, things they had held back in these relationships before because they're desperate for, you know, Iranian drones or North Korean artillery or whatever. And so, you know, just from the public reporting, there's, you know, apparently concern that the Russians may be helping the North Koreans with their, you know, missile and advanced weapons capabilities, things of that nature, that are going to help North Koreans hit certain milestones sooner. And if the Russians were to do things like share some of their most advanced sub-quieting technology with the Chinese, that would have serious implications for the undersea balance of power in the Western Pacific. And it would have serious implications in one of the few domains where the U.S. still has sort of unquestioned supremacy over the Chinese. And you wouldn't need a formal alliance to get there.
Yeah, I mean, you have in the article, you make some interesting you use some examples from the interwar years where these kinds of quasi-alliances covert alliances, I think Rapallo, it's fair to say, was kind of a covert alliance. Could you talk a little bit about those and why, you know, more broadly, you know, this seems like we're going back to the future. I mean, it does seem like the interwar years, you know, have a lot to say to us today. I mean, in part because we're back in a world of great power competition, and this time around, instead of being a bipolar competition, it's got a lot of we've got, you know, two great powers that we're dealing with, but also some lesser powers that are either already nuclear armed or aspire to being nuclear armed, which make it very complicated.
So I think there are probably two major takeaways. The first is that the most dysfunctional alliances can still create the most disruptive effects. And so if you go back to the Rapallo Pact between then still democratic Germany and the Soviet Union after World War I, basically between two of the big losers of World War I, or you think about the series of bilateral pacts that eventually added up to the tripartite pact between Italy, Imperial Japan, and Nazi Germany during World War II, or you think about the Nazi-Soviet pact of 1939. I mean, these were some of the most ill-fated alliances in history. In two out of three cases, the members ended up fighting and trying to destroy each other. Had the fascist powers somehow won World War II, they undoubtedly would have torn each other apart after the fact. There was not a lot of love in these relationships. And nonetheless, they managed to create these tremendously destabilizing effects, whether in the way that Molotov-Ribbentrop allowed the Soviet Union and Germany to undertake these parallel efforts to reshape big parts of Europe militarily because they were no longer fearful of coming into conflict with each other, even if only temporarily. Or whether it's in the way that Rapallo, or more precisely, that the secret military protocols that Rapallo made possible facilitated particularly German rearmament after World War I, and thus gave Hitler that crucial head start in the race to rearm in Europe during the 1930s. You know, as long as these things lasted, they created real damage. And so the takeaway for us is don't take much comfort from the fact that, you know, Russia and China probably aren't destined to get along forever. You know, the period between now and forever can be pretty long, and they can do some damage between now and then. The second takeaway is regional conflicts can add up to global crisis or global cataclysm, as it sometimes goes. So, you know, we often think of World War II as a global conflict, but that's mostly because of the peculiarities of the American experience. The U.S. joins both the European and the Asian wars late, and it joins them almost simultaneously because of the attack on Pearl Harbor and then Hitler's decision to declare war on the United States a few days later. But that's not how World War II started. World War II started as three separate regional conflicts that were caused by Germany's drive for hegemony in Europe, Italy's push for primacy around the Mediterranean Rim and in Africa, and Japan's drive for dominance in East Asia and the Western Pacific, that intensified and became more tightly interwoven over time and then merged in catastrophic ways. And that gives us, I think, a new and somewhat sobering way of thinking about the global situation today, where you already have wars underway in two of the three key theaters of Eurasia, Eastern Europe and the Middle East. You have rising tensions in the third theater, which is the Western Pacific, and you have the conflicts and crises in these regions becoming more tightly interwoven as the ties between the Eurasian autocracies in particular become more pronounced. And so, you know, I don't worry so much about a scenario where Xi and Putin and Khamenei or his successor get together and say, like, hey, let's attack the world all at once. I don't think that's what's going to happen. I worry about a scenario in which you have these conflicts that intensify, they escalate, and they become more tightly woven together in a way that gets us into an incredibly disordered global environment as sort of the sum total of these regional conflicts.
Yeah, I completely agree with that, sadly. We're running a little short on time, Hal. And I want to, you know, had we had more time, I wanted to get into Ukraine as the, as you know, the key to the geopolitical heartland. But I know you've got a book coming out on geopolitics towards the end of the year, so I'm going to hold that in abeyance so you can pull even further ahead of Peter Fever and appearances on Shield of the Republic. But I do want to touch on one final issue before we let you go, and that is there's another way in which the current moment seems to very much be redolent of the 1930s, and that's the recrudescence of isolationism, particularly in the Republican Party. It's a phenomenon that Bob Kagan has written about recently in a very lengthy piece in the Washington Post. I wrote about it from a slightly different angle in Sapir. You've written several things about how this is more and more like the 30s. And, you know, my take on this is that this was, there was a tradition in the Republican Party of this. It was largely located in the Midwest and by and large among progressive Republicans. But not only, included conservatives, certainly like Robert Taft, who became perhaps the most well-known spokesperson for this point of view or persuasion inside the Republican Party. That kind of view was sort of suppressed in some sense in 1952 by Eisenhower. And it continued to have an existence, you know, in the form of John Bricker, Pat Buchanan and others who continued to hold that view, but it was very much a minority view in the Republican Party. Donald Trump, who very much, I think, you know, sort of harkens back to this. It's, I think, his views, you know, eerily similar to, you know, ones that Taft articulated. And that's something that Tom Wright, you know, formerly of Brookings, now inside the Biden administration, and George Will have all, you know, taken notice of. And I guess my question to you is, do you think this is a kind of lasting shift in the Republican Party? Is this an epiphenomenon connected to Trump? Is there a way back? How do you see this playing out?
So there are obviously deeper roots within the Republican Party. But I guess I would say I think it's illustrative that none of the Trump wannabes in the Republican Party have managed to capture the enthusiasm and the energy of the base in the way that Trump has, which indicates to me that a lot of what's happening with Trump is more about personal connection. It's about a psychological connection. It's about emotion than it is about policy per se. And it also indicates to me that, you know, if and when Trump passes from the scene, and the first thing that needs to happen is he needs to lose in November. But if and when he passes from the scene, there's going to be a fight for the soul of the Republican Party on this. And, you know, you currently at this point, it would be hard to bet against the neo-isolationist types. But, you know, the person who came in second in the Republican primary was Nikki Haley, who would have been quite at home in the George W. Bush administration or under Ronald Reagan, was sort of a more traditional Republican internationalism. And so I think it's better to say that the fight will be on rather than the fight will be over once Trump and his time on the national stage has come to an end.
Well, Hal, it's been great to have you on. Our guest has been Hal Brands, historian, prolific author, columnist, essayist, and for the moment, editor of a new volume, War in Ukraine, Conflict Strategy, and the Return of a Fractured World. Hal, thanks for being with us on Shield of the Republic, and look forward to having you back.
Thanks so much for having me, Eric.